Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview, where our guest today is Sadiqua Johnson, and we are going to be talking about The House of Eve, which is a New York Times bestseller and a Book Reporter Bets On selection, which is a lot less, but you know, still, like we've been talking about this book. I have been looking forward to reading this book since I finished Yellow Wife, which was her first book. And I immediately said, what is this woman going to do next? I want to see it. And at the time, it was her first foray into historical fiction. She says, I like this. I'm going to write another one. So I was really ready. A reviewer, Pamela Kramer, says Sadiqua Johnson's The House of Eve focuses on 3 years in the lives of two young but very different Black women. It is touching and informative, but also detailed and carefully researched. So we've talked before. Welcome back, Sadiqua. It is so nice to have you here with us.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Thank you again for the invitation.
So every book has something that's the springboard to get it started. And for yours, I do know the backstory, which was interesting. So let's start with that, because I think it'll give readers, it's in your author's note at the end, a little bit of like, oh, this is why I don't want to touch on the story.
Yeah. Well, after I finished Yellow Wife, as you mentioned, that was my first historical fiction. And I knew that it was the best that I had to offer. Like, I just knew it. Literature-wise, because, you know, I have three wonderful kids, so I can't say, you know, my absolute best. But literature-wise, I knew Yellow Wife was my best. And the question that kept going through my head was, how do you better your best? And that was a little bit scary. So I was sort of working and writing and playing around, and I kept getting this one particular character, and her name was Ruby. And I knew that she was smart. I knew that she was 15. I knew that she had a body shaped like a Coca-Cola bottle, right? Like the old Coca-Cola bottles. And that when she walked through the streets of North Philadelphia, she was catcalled by grown men. So I knew she was in sexual danger. But I also knew that she had a mother who wished she had never been born. And that sort of made me think about my own family history. My grandmother told me that she was the Black sheep of our family. She got pregnant with my mom at 14 and she had her at 15. It was the early 1950s. She was unmarried. There was no husband in sight. And so they hid the pregnancy from everyone, including the child. And then my mom tells me she didn't know my grandmother was her mother until she was in the third grade, because up until that point, she had lived with her grandmother and it was never openly discussed. And it really got me thinking about shame and secrecy, women in the 40s and the 50s, you know, what options did they have when they found themselves in trouble, you know, when they found themselves pregnant and unwed. And that was sort of the beginning of writing The House of Eve.
Yeah. Ruby was the character that came first. She was cemented in your head. Were there always two central characters? I mean, Ruby was there. Then did you say you're going to do two? Did you think about three, or was it the two solidified?
It was always Ruby's story, actually. And to be quite honest, Eleanor came much later. I was sort of working on the outline, and I knew the story I wanted to tell, and I was trying to figure out how to do it. I was sitting in my office one day, and I felt this energy kind of come, and it was rageful, it was defiant, it was desperate. And I kept hearing, I need your help. I need to have a baby. And I thought, okay, where did she come from? And so I knew she had an E name. I wasn't quite sure. Sometimes the characters will come and it'll just be a letter. So I knew she had an E name, and I thought, okay, let me write down everything that she's telling me, because, you know, I believe in that Elizabeth Gilbert's big magic that when a character finds you, you only have a certain amount of time to say yes, or otherwise they're off to the races and they'll find somebody to write their story. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let me write this down and figure out how to use her later. But it was so aggressive that I thought, whoa, what do I do with this? So it took me a little bit of a little while to figure out how to bring both of those characters together and tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're two central characters. They're very different in a lot of ways, and they become the same and then they become different again. And the way you're weaving their stories together, you know, Ruby has some issues. And when she learns that Inez is her mother, it's something that she didn't realize before. And you like this moment of surprise. And I can't quite imagine what it was like to have like a teenager in the house and say, oh, by the way, that's your mother after all this time. Mm-hmm. What was your mom's reaction to it? Was she stunned or?
Yeah, she never really talked about being stunned when she found out. It was more when she didn't know. You know, when she didn't know, she called her mother Miss Yvonne. You know, she didn't know. She thought she was, I don't know who she thought she was if she called her Miss Yvonne, you know? So I think it was a while for them to both get over the shame, because I think after my grandmother had gone to, you know, 8-9 years without claiming her as her daughter, probably was some sort of hard time for them to sort of kind of gel as mother and daughter. And I could see this tension play out in their relationship, you know, mm-hmm. over time. I could always see they were snappy. I knew that they loved each other, you know, at the heart of it. I knew that it was love, but it was still this this forgiveness that needed to happen on both of their part, and this reckoning that, you know, this is our history, but this doesn't need to be our future. You know, it was all of that that I could feel between them.
Mm-hmm. And you're a young child and you're just viewing this, like you could actually see. And is your grandmother still alive?
She's no, alive? My grandmother passed on. Yeah.
And is your mom still alive?
Yeah, my mom is still here.
So when you started writing this, were you talking to her about it and what her feelings were as being the Ruby? You
know, yeah, well, I was always sort of poking around in her history and asking her questions about growing up in North Philadelphia. And, you know, she's and her big joke is, you're going to have to pay me for this information, Sadiqua. So that usually is the joke between us when I'm poking around in her history.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I told the story before, so the listeners may already know it. My mother's father was the only one who came to America. And my mother went and visited the entire family in Italy and never asked why he left. And I was like, why did you not ask that question? So my mom sadly passed away last summer, but my boys have gone, we're going and we're asking the question. And they said, because everybody else still lives there in the same village. And we're like, what happened? And my son goes, we're going to go find out. That's our family trip. And I was like, okay. But I see that I've done this before. The family trip becomes I'm paying for everything. And all of a sudden we're on like a much bigger trip. Like while we're there, let's go to Provence. You know what I mean? Like we're going to go. Like the cabin on the QE2 became a suite. Like I know how that goes. I really do.
No? Yes.
So did you write all of Ruby before you started writing Eleanor, or were you just partially into it?
So the way I, you know, this was my first time writing from two different perspectives. And I sort of got the idea I read Lisa Wingate's book, Before We Were Yours. And I remember she was going every other chapter. So when I read, I'm reading for craft too. I'm trying to learn in addition to being entertained. And I thought, wow, she's going back and forth between the two characters. It's working. I could read two chapters a night, put it down, and then come back to it. So I said, maybe I'll try that. But I couldn't, in the beginning, I was like, well, how do you do that? So what I decided was I would write all of Ruby, part one, because that would keep me in her world and I could sort of see things unfold and shape for her. And then at the end of part one, I would push her aside and then I would write Eleanor from the beginning to the end of part one. Then I would take those two parts and I would read them and sort of figure out what the entry point was. And I always think of it like braiding hair. I have two girls, so hair is a thing in our family. So braiding hair is the first analogy that comes to my head. And so I would take their stories and sort of overlay it like you braid hair, making sure that it was neat and that, you know, that it sort of fit where I'm telling two different stories, but you see the similarities as we move through the story with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And was Ruby easier to write than Eleanor once you got started, or did Eleanor come along?
I felt like I was closer to Ruby because she lived in, I grew up in Philadelphia. She lived in North Philadelphia. She lived in the apartment that my mom told me about, you know, there's something very sweet about writing about where you're from. And I haven't lived in Philadelphia since I was 18 years old, but there's still something very sweet about writing about home. Mm-hmm. So I felt closer to her because of that. You know, I wrote her in first person. I wrote Eleanor in third person, which gave me a little bit of a distance. But I didn't like one character more than the other. It was just the feeling that I had when we were together.
And I like the first and the third, so that if you're listening on audio, you knew the difference between them. And it's really hard for readers on audio to know that there's a difference. I mean, I know that they're two narrators, but also to know, here's a line break. Here's a line break. We're going to somebody else now. And you had two narrators, which we'll speak about later on as well. But it's also them trying to follow the story. Because if there are two Ruby chapters or there's two whatever, like, well, wait, where are we now? And it's that... It's tough to not get people lost. It really is. You did a good job because it's tough. It's really tough, you know? So at one point, there's a guy, Shimmy, who's interested in Ruby, and she's telling him she wants to become a doctor. She's wants to become a doctor. She wants to become an eye doctor. She wants to be able to help her grandmother, people like her grandmother. And he said he's never heard of a colored doctor. And she says, I'm Negro, not colored. And she points out colored is a painful word used by segregationists trying to keep our race down. So I understand that. I understand there was a period where everybody was spoken about as being Negro. When did the transition to calling everyone Black happen? When was that? Am I right that there's a change?
Yeah,
now?
So there's definitely a change. And when I'm writing, I always have to go back. And because, you know, Black, African-American, colored, Negro, it depends on what time period you're writing about. So as I'm, that's part of my research. Yeah. You know, as I research, I'm also looking at language. I read books during that period to see what other authors have done. You know, I'll read textbooks to see how are Black people referred to in the stories, you know, during that time period. Mm-hmm. And it changes, you know, every 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. And I just found it interesting because I wasn't thinking like that. And then I remember when I was growing up, you referred to people differently. And I think that was, it was a really interesting moment. Eleanor, meanwhile, was learning that Black comes in shades, something that she never considered when she was growing up in Ohio. And there's a prejudice against her how because she's too dark. And she had thought that when she got to school, race was not going to be an issue, especially going to school there. And you mentioned in your afterword that Toni Morrison learned this when she went to Howard as well. And you layered that in. So talk to us about that. Like, you know, it's something where I know it's a big thing at Howard. I know people have gone there and they said, I wasn't in this sorority because I was too dark. I was only in this one. So,
well, I don't think that it was specifically only for Howard University. I think it was probably the time period, HBCUs, historical Black colleges and universities, just in general. But I really love that when I was researching Eleanor's character, I watched Toni Morrison's documentary, The Pieces I Am. And she said that when she grew up in Ohio, you know, she said everybody sort of was together. She grew up with Germans and Poles and Irish and Italians, and everybody was just trying to make it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until she got to Howard University's campus in the 1950s that she realized that Black people separated themselves by color. And this was a very real thing, you know. Colorism is leftover baggage from slavery, right? So if you think about Yellow Wife, and you saw that Phoebe was very light-skinned, she was the master's daughter, she worked at the house, and then we have the darker-skinned people working in the fields. And so this is a continuation through the history. And so now we're in the 50s, and it's colorism. And so it's, is your skin lighter than a paper bag? Is your hair straighter than a ruler? And some sororities and fraternities would do the paper bag test to see if you could be a part of it. And as we see, Eleanor had her challenges in that direction.
Yeah. I remember one friend that she was getting married. And I remember this is when I was working. And they said, she's allowed to marry him, even though he's darker, because he has a really good job. And it was okay. And it wasn't like he had to find his way. He was already there. And I found that was, I had never, ever considered this or given it a thought. And she said, no, it's a very big thing. So I was like, wow. You know, Eleanor, though, is thus charged with having to be better even among her own race. Like, she felt like she had to be better. And she sees herself as less, that she'd never seen herself as before. And now her pregnancy is seen as a way to nail a husband. And meanwhile, coming from love. And through her, like, I think there's a better path than for Ruby. But was her path your plan? Like, you know, what she was doing, she came from Ohio, she comes there, and then all of a sudden she finds that her world is not what she thought it was, just the same as your mom, you know, coming from, like, you know, wherever, you know, everybody was the same.
Well, I was pretty clear of the story that I wanted to tell, but I was having a hard time figuring out how to tell the story. And the story that I wanted to tell is to answer the question, what if my grandmother had other opportunities? What options were available to her in the 1950s when she found mm-hmm. herself unmarried and pregnant? And what I found was that there were these maternity homes for yes. girls that yes. they can go to have a baby and that they could go back home like it never happened, right? But it wasn't as cut and dry as that. And so in my research, I found between 1943 and 1975, 1.5 million babies were given up for adoption in these homes. They were forced adoptions in a lot of cases. Sometimes the girls knew what they were going to the home for. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they went to give up their baby and changed their minds. And when they changed their minds, they were coerced, they were forced. They were told that if they didn't sign the papers, they could go to jail, that they were psychotic, that they had issues, that they were unfit to raise these children. And when I continued to dig, I found that most of these homes were largely for white women. Mm-hmm. And this was before IVF. And so if there was a married couple that wanted to have a baby, this was the best way to do it in secrecy. No one would know. It was sort of that way of adoption. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the story I wanted to tell. Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell the story from a Black woman's perspective. And so when Eleanor came into the story and she marries into this very upper echelon, you know, Black family that could trace their roots and their money back three generations, you know, William is the third generation doctor in his family. There were doctors and lawyers and judges. And I thought, well, where else would she meet them but at Howard University, which was a premier college for historical Black college and university. Howard has graduated more African-American doctors than any other university in the whole entire country. Wow. So I knew if she was gonna meet someone who was connected, it needed to be there.
Right, so that part of the story was, okay, let's get her path going in the right direction. And yet, okay, so education for her, she knows is her way to better herself. Ruby knows that's a ticket out of her life as well. And she works hard to get that prize, but she continually gets obstacles thrown in her way. Like she doesn't have dinner. She doesn't have this. She can't get to school on time. She can't get to the extra classes on time. But the big one is her pregnancy. From the start, did you know what each woman's challenge was going to be?
I knew what each woman's challenges was going to be. I just wasn't sure what the outcome was going to be. I had an idea, but I left a little space for them to sort of tell me as we went along the journey.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give too much away because there's a lot that the readers are going to unfold as time goes on. It's like hard to talk about a book where there's so much that happens.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give this stuff away. But Eleanor's job involves research and it's something that she loves, but in it, she discovers things about history that surprise her. So was having the job a good way for you to present facts that you didn't have to say fact, fact, fact? Instead, Eleanor is saying, this is what I learned. This is what I learned.
Well, I do love writing historical fiction because I get to teach, but I get to do it sort of in a sneaky way. Yeah. I always think about it like sneaking like chopped spinach and spaghetti. The kids don't quite know that they're eating vegetables, but they're eating something healthy. And so that's the way I think of writing historical fiction. But really, Eleanor's job working at the library sort of happened by accident. It wasn't something that I had planned. I've always been a lover of the library, so I gravitate towards anything, you know, that way. But I think the biggest discovery that I found in sort of figuring out where Eleanor was going to work and how she was going to move through Howard was the discovery of Dorothy Porter Wesley, mm-hmm. which is Eleanor's boss in the story. She is an archivist at Howard University. She was a real life person who I discovered and I thought, oh my gosh, not enough people know who this brilliant, talented woman is who gave so much to our culture and our history. And so she needs a spot in my story. And so for those who don't know, Dorothy Porter Wesley was an archivist and a librarian. She spent over 40 years amassing the largest collection of Black artifacts, articles, letters, poetry, poems, pamphlets, photography, records, anything that she could get her hands on. She was known as the shopping bag lady because she would go in people's basements and root around in dusty attics. And she said that she could always find something that the untrained eye wouldn't see. She could find those little treasures. And she didn't have a lot of money to amass this collection, but she had friends everywhere. So people were constantly gifting and sending her things. Her collection, as she called it, her collection, is housed at the Moreland Spingarn Research Center at Howard University. She also had an issue with the Dewey Decimal System, because as she was classifying all of these pieces, she realized that the Dewey Decimal System only had two sections, one for slavery and one for colonization. And she said, Dewey Decimal System, be damned. And so she came up with her own system that made more sense to qualify all of her works and findings.
Wow. Well, and you talk about somebody you really do want to pay tribute to, simply because of this is what she did. And to tell a story instead of what the narrative has been for years, here's the true narrative of what's going on. And it's sort of what Eleanor is having, this moment of understanding her history at the same time as she's in a place where she feels a little bit different. She's got this great boyfriend that is a little bit different as well. And it's like, he's wealthy. She's coming from a different place. How does she talk to her parents about him? They end up, you know, getting married. It's nothing that, like, you know, you don't tell, like, you know, quite quickly in the book, but what does his mother really feel about her all the time? And what is, you know, she had other plans for him and she's very, very clear about it. So,
yeah, I think the mothers in the story really reflect all sides of motherhood. My agent and I were talking yesterday and she said, one of the things that Sadiqua always writes about is love and mother-daughter relationships. Motherhood is very central to my book. And I think with The House of Eve, one of the things that I really wanted to do was to show motherhood in all its sides, right? Like, because I'm convinced now that all mothers are really doing the best they can in that moment. And it might not feel like that for the child. It might not look like that to other people, but in that moment, that is the absolute best that she has to give to her child. And I wanted to show that in all the different layers, right? And so with William and his mother, you see her as this, you know, villainous character, but in her mind, really, she's thinking she's protecting her son and building legacy and keeping wealth and all of those things that she deems important.
Mm-hmm. And she wants it to be the exact right woman coming into his life that can help him further himself and whatever. And is this woman going to be able to do it? Let me have a conversation with you and explain who we are and what we do. And it's the mother-in-law that you are afraid of. Luckily, I didn't have one of those. You know what I mean?
Me either, actually. I had a wonderful mother-in-law. I was very, very blessed.
So you give readers a hard look at what was like before women had options. And it's something that we've been talking about a lot these last couple of months, is what happens when the options go away of being able to do the homes for unwed mothers, the mothers sent to live, people sent out of town with family, backroom abortions. They were all the standard fare. That's everything that always happened. And your timing for this focus couldn't have been better timed to be sitting and taking us back to the way things were. Were you able to speak to a lot of people about what it was like in those times, like what it was like to be someone who had given up a child, or why the decision was made that your mother did and how they hid it? I mean, hiding things was, like, you know, really crazy too.
Yeah. Well, on the timeliness of the novel, it's amazing to me how I never set out to write a novel that's timely, but the world just folds itself around whatever I'm writing, because when Roe v. Wade was overturned, I think I was on the fifth draft of the book. And so I just thought, like, oh my goodness, look, I'm right here. When I was researching the book, I came across a book called, it was by Anne Fessler, called The Girls Who Went Away. Mm-hmm. And in it, she details the story of 100 women who went into these maternity homes and what their stories were. So I read that. And then I reached out to her and we talked a little bit about her research. And so she was very, very helpful and informative to help me figure out, you know, what their lives were like. But I didn't speak to anyone specific. It was more so just that sort of research.
Yeah. Just, and I think a book like that is going to just give you so much of an eye opener of what was it like to, you know, go someplace else when you had your whole life here, and then to give up a child and wonder And, you know, now there are so many ways that people can find their parents. They can go back and say, who was my mother, and reintroduce this, like, is it a good thing for these women or not a good thing for these women? Yeah. They want to be found or not want to be found. Such an interesting thing, because today this is what we'd be able to do. Like, we'd be able to find mm-hmm. anybody. Back then, you may never have been able to find your child. You know?
Yeah.
So Eleanor is the one who names in her head the house of Eve, referencing to the biblical Eve. Was that the moment you knew the title?
No, it was not. My original title was Where the Bad Girls Go.
Ooh.
Because that was when I was looking into these homes, that the girls were always like, this is where the bad girls went. Fallen women, wayward girls. But I had written that in, that Eleanor had thought of these girls as Eve's first woman. Mm-hmm. And then as I was working with my publisher and we were trying to find different titles, you know, we're throwing 75, 80, 90 titles to see what's going to stick a bit against the wall. And that was one that they sort of brought back to me. And I thought, wow, that's perfect. And then I just sort of went back in and tweaked it a little bit. So it felt like the title had always been the title.
Well, I was fooled. I thought that was the title all along. And it was just really good because she thinks of it as the house of Eve. This is the house yeah. where the mothers come from. It completely works. Use an epigraph at the start of part four. And there are definite parts in the book. There are no good girls gone wrong, just bad girls found out. And that's Mae West. And I just love that you threw that quote there. Let's talk about that. Do you like save quotes and say, I might use this someday? Or do you sit there and say, I got to find a quote for this section?
Yeah, it's more I have to find a quote for the section, because for me, the quotes sort of give me direction on where I'm going. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard for me to start a novel without knowing what my opening quote is. They're in all five of my novels. There's always a quote to start the book. There's always one to start each part of the book, because it sort of gives me the framework of where I'm going. It makes me feel like, okay, now it's time to write.
Okay, now I can breathe. And the same thing with chapter titles. You always have those in advance
same.
Too? Yes.
I don't have the chapter titles in advance. The chapter titles sort of are born out of the chapter. But I have to have a chapter title in order to sort of, it keeps me organized. And it also, I guess I'm telling little stories within a big story. Mm-hmm. So everything has to have the right framework around it for me in order for it to feel like I can move on to the next thing.
And what I'm going to suggest to readers is, after you finish reading the book, go back and read the chapter titles. Because a lot of times when you're going into the chapter, you're not sure why it's there. But later on, you're going to see how clever the use of words of what's right, or let's see if I can find another one, cracks and crevices are. And you see how, and I like when people, look, the author didn't do it for nothing. You didn't do this just because, oh, I think I got to come up with something there. There's a reason that word was there. There's a reason. And you may have changed them along the way and said, I want to make this something different. But I feel like people skip through those sometimes. And to go back and read the epigraphs, to go back and read the chapter titles, there's something clever usually there. There's something wry and there's a clue, but sometimes you don't get it and you have to go back and look. Is that, is that a good challenge for
everybody? Yes, I love that challenge.
I love it, because I sat there, the Mae West quote, like, you know, slayed me, because it's like, oh yes, look what that's, you know, put into the middle of this book. You get readers to go back in time with your food references and your fashions. And I know you love fashion. So what was it like going back? I mean, the woman on the cover of the book is just so like iconic. The shirtwaist dress is iconic of the time. So how much fun was it to do the food as well as the dress?
You know, food and fashion are things that I really enjoy writing about, because I am in music too. So food, fashion, and music, what it does is it transports the reader into that time period. I'm asking you to come along on a journey with me. And so I have to give you little clues and little things to sort of pull you into that setting. the fashion is always good because I will just Google, you know, what did women wear in the 1950s? Mm-hmm. And there's this wonderful website called Vintage Dancer that I love to use because it'll tell you the gloves and the nylons and the shoes and the hats and sort of every pictures and descriptions. And so I use that a lot for my fashion.
And I loved when Ruby went to the department store with her grandmother and or her aunt, and they were going in and they were going to buy her the stockings. And we don't think of it quite the same way anymore of what it was like to go shopping for things. I mean, I order a lot of things that get delivered here. I don't go shopping mm-hmm. quite the same way. And it was, you know, that thing of going into the store and touching the nylons and figuring out what's going on. And remember, like, all the different colors that used to be on, you know, like some panel that yeah. you looked at, whatever. And she gets this great joy in doing this, and then the joy is taken away. And I'm not going to talk about how, but it's joy came and joy went like so quickly. And it yeah. was, and that became garbage. And the way that scene unfolds, it becomes the treat became garbage because yeah. of something that happened. And
well, I hope that people will read that scene and realize how powerful your words are. Our words are very, very powerful. And you never know when you're going to say something that is going to completely wreck and change someone's direction.
Mm-hmm. Change someone's direction, make them feel less than, make them feel not equal to. There's so many different ways that you realize that somebody could just say something, a look being dismissed. I mean, there were times with Eleanor, it wasn't even what people were saying, it's the way they were looking at her in the room. And there's this other woman that, you know, she knows was set up to be with her husband. And that woman is cruel to her as time goes on. So it's not even just people outside. And I think you were very good at showing that it's not just people outside your race. It's people inside can be just as cruel. And this woman yeah. is.
You know? Yeah. I think what happens between the two narratives is that we see Ruby really dealing with the outside world and the ugly heads of racism. And then we see Eleanor dealing with the inside world and the ugly heads of colorism. And they're happening side by side as they move through the story.
Yeah. And it's, you have something, I have something. You think I've gotten better? It's not. You think that just because I've got an education, now I'm okay. I'm not really, because I'm not this. And it's a lot about, like, you know, what's not. There's a subtle reference to Yellow Wife. I picked up on it. Our reviewer picked up on it. And was that always planned, or is that a little Easter egg you dropped in later?
That was something I sort of decided early on. Okay. I know that readers often want to know, you know, what's going on with their friends from a previous book. And so mm-hmm. if I can deliver, I usually try to do that.
Yeah. Well, it was really fun because I was like, wait a second, I know what's going on here. That's fun. Mm-hmm. This is your second work of historical fiction. Was this one more or less challenging than writing Yellow Wife?
This one was less challenging okay. because Yellow Wife took place over 100 years before I was born, right? And so it was like everything was textbooks and research. Whereas with The House of Eve, you know, I could talk to people in my family and get a sense for what life was like back then. You know, it was easier to talk to people who actually experienced some of these moments versus in Yellow Wife. It really was my imagination, my research, characters coming through me, ancestors speaking to me, hoping I'm getting what they're saying right. So it was a little bit easier for me to write The House of Eve.
Yeah. And it's like there are a lot more people you'd be able to talk to. So do you write on a schedule? Do you say I'm going to do morning? I can't remember from our last conversation. Are you a schedule girl? I'm guessing you are.
I do prefer to write. I do prefer to write in the mornings. I have a middle schooler. So she, you know, she's my time clock. So I know I need to get up at 6:30, get her to the bus. I can write all that time. And then I need to pick her up at, you know, between 3 and 4, whatever that is. And so that's sort of my time to get everything done. So usually writing is first. And then the business, you know, the business of being an author is a whole nother 2 or 3 hours of my day as well. So I have to figure out how to fit that all in. And some days I'm more Sadiq with the author. Some days I'm more Sadiq with the writer. Right now I'm more Sadiq with the author. Yeah. But I am thinking of my new story. And so I'm getting myself together, like, it's coming. We're about to sit down. We're going to start working on this. So every day I'm like, we're getting a little closer. So it's time for us to start figuring this thing out.
Well, you know, it's, you can't do it when you're on tour. I mean, you absolutely can't, because you're either trying to make the plane, the hotel, sit down, figure out where you're going to eat. Something's delayed, and then go to an event. and talk about the book that you're doing now. How can you be hatching something else? But I have had friends that said the book was written so long ago that I have to reread it. Because the readers, especially when they start talking, if you're three or four books in about the first book, and you're like, which character was that? Oh, tell me about the character, because I don't remember them either. So yeah, it's like really, really, you know.
I can relate.
You can relate. Yeah, because right now I'm sitting there going, let's do something. It's like, I don't know if I could really sit down and do, you can't start doing the research. You can't start doing X, Y, Z. And I think it's the reason it's so hard to do a book a year. People are doing a book a year. It's, you're on a whole different schedule of really having no free time. And that business of being an author, I think readers think that I sit and read all day long and then bang out a newsletter on Friday. And just the social media part of posting things and responding and
with the content. That's the part that gets me like, okay, what do I post today? You know, coming up with the content is a whole nother beast.
Whole other thing. And then I said, I really need like a content calendar to remind me. And then I need a buzzer to go off to remind me to do it. And people are saying like, oh, you know, you can get some, like everybody tells me that there's some teenager that wants to do this. And I'm like, I have not.
And I have two that live in my house. So I guarantee you they are not easy to find.
No, I said, they're not like flying over here going, pick me, I'll do this for you. And then it's got to be in the right voice. It's like, I'm big on voice tone and attitude, as I'm sure you are as well. It's got to have the right thing. It's got to sound like me that's coming out there. So it's going to be me, you know?
It's going to be me. I've come to that conclusion as well, Carol. It's just going to be me.
It's just going to be me.
And I'll just do my best. That's all I can do.
And you're just hoping that one of them will go away. And someday I will learn how to do stories and reels. But right now I'm just posting and we got to be happy with that. But
I just learned how to do reels probably like 3 months ago. So I can help you a little bit.
Yeah, you sit there and do that. I mean, it's like, really, it's like somebody said, Carol, it's not that hard. And I turn around. Yeah. It's another thing It's another thing. The other day I was sitting and we had had something really good for dinner. I went to take a picture. Tom goes, that's not photogenic. My husband's going, that's not photogenic. I was like, but it was good. You know, he goes, no, it needs a green. Don't take that picture. I was like, look where we are. Speaking of the cover, let's talk about the cover. Was this the first cover you saw? Or did you guys play around?
Absolutely not. But let me tell you, the first cover that comes down always almost gives me a heart attack every time because I'm like, oh my gosh, they have no idea what's in my head. This is not what I was talking about. This is not going to go well. You know, it takes a while of back and forth conversations until we get to it. So I think it's at least three or four rounds before we get to that one. But I am very, very pleased with it.
This is beautiful. I mean, it's stunning. It sticks out. It says something. It's got all the right things going for it. It really does. The audio is narrated by Ariel Blake and Nicole Lewis. Did you go into this knowing you wanted to have two narrators, or did they present that to you as a idea?
They presented it to me as an idea, which I was very thrilled because it didn't even cross my mind that we should have two narrators. So when they presented it, I thought, ooh, that's a good idea. Yes.
Yeah. And I think it keeps the reader focused as well. Because as I said, a number of book club readers have said they listened on audio and it's a completely different experience. There's one where the book will remain nameless, but we sat in book club and one person says, I don't like this book at all. And other people did. And you realize that she had listened to a narration that she just didn't enjoy. And it can dilute. And it used to be, I would say that audio used to be like your rights to Finland. Like it didn't really matter. And then audio became such a big deal that you wanted to make sure the performance was really good. So that, and it was also embodying what you wanted to be able to share with your readers as well.
Yeah, listeners,
you know. So you've been on this extended tour. You were kind of like up and down the East Coast, I believe.
West Coast, Midwest, everywhere.
Everywhere. And okay, this is the first time you've been out because the last book it was COVID days. You didn't tour, correct?
Yeah.
Had you toured with your previous books?
Yes, I toured a little bit with the other, my second and my third novel, like smaller tours, like 4 or 5 city tours. So this was a 6-week tour, which was the largest that I've done.
Right.
Because Yellow Wife was all virtual. So Yellow Wife, if you want to call it a tour, you know, that went on forever and ever and ever because everything was virtual. But this was 6 weeks of me moving about the country, meeting people, which was wonderful. It's so lovely to get out and meet your readers and talk to them and take pictures and, you know, hear what they have to say. Like, it's just, it was a fantastic tour.
And did you have good crowds? Like, was it good to go out and actually meet the people and hear? Like, they came up afterwards and they're talking to you about your last book. And then had some of them read House of Eve already, or were they all?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I would say every audience, at least 70% have read Yellow Wife, every single audience.
Wow.
And I would say maybe 30 to 40% had already read The House of Eve, and then the rest had come to hear what I had to say and to get their copy and get a copy signed.
Wow. So when you were sitting there having these conversations, you've got people that are giving you real feedback on the book while you're trying to not give anything away to the rest of the audience. So
yes, always. But I feel like I've done a really good job of having my talking points sort of skirt around the spoilers, but give just enough to get you interested, but not give anything away.
Yeah, yeah. So did I miss anything? Did I miss anything about the book that you still want to talk about? Because I'm trying to figure out if there's any little other kernel. So I did all these folding data pages and I was reading today. I just think it's so interesting the way you see both characters very vividly. You very much see what these girls, what these women were going through, both of them. And, you know, the sadness that Eleanor goes through a lot on a lot of different levels where everybody thinks she's got it made. And
yeah.
I think you do a lot about talking about people who think we think people have it all. And what do they really, does anybody have it all?
Yeah. And is it even possible?
Is it possible? Or do you make your best all? Is that what you're going to do, is make the best of what you can do?
Yeah, so that's it. Yeah. I mean, just personally, I try and live each day like it's the best. You know, I personally try and think like, okay, well, today is the day. How am I going to, you know, make this my best?
Right. And if yesterday didn't go well, it's behind us. Let's just keep on going and we'll
start over. You get to start over tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And with the book, you've got something now, you've got two books, two pieces of historical fiction that readers can read about two different, very different periods of time, but read it through your eyes where storytelling has become such a fabulous way for you to convey what goes on. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how much I speak highly of both of the books. I recommend them umpteen times. I'm doing a presentation this week, and even though it's a February book, tough luck, you still get to hear about it. That's it.
Well, thank you, Kara. I appreciate that. It's definitely a labor of love, but I don't know what else I would do if I wasn't doing this. So I'm really grateful that I get to tell stories.
Even on the days it's tough, it's going to be the best day the next day.
Yeah, because even on the days it's tough, just give me 2 days and I'll get past it.
But you know, even think about what you've learned about history. And what you've learned by diving deep into history, and how much when we were in school, it was really skirted at the top. Mm-hmm. And how much I wish that classes and everything were done differently, because it's not about memorizing dates and battles. It's really, truly not. It's what happened and where the cause and effect was later on. For years in our geography class, we had like, you know, Pedro goes to like, you know, he lives here and this is it. And I could picture what Pedro was doing in his town. And picture much more of what was going on instead of just reading this flat text about what was happening. Pedro was in Argentina. He was wearing his little, like, you know, serape. I mean, I remember all this stuff. It was great. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a much easier way to learn. And I think that one thing that we're running into right now is because of all the outside noise that happens with teens, kids, up to about the age, I think it's up to about the age of 24. Like I'll use that, like probably Generation Z, like where it starts going back from there. The noise coming at them and the attention span is completely different. So I feel like reading a book like this gives them such a glimpse into what this time was like, far better than sitting and reading a history book that says this is what happened in the 50s to this group of people. And I feel like layering in books like this, even into curriculum and things like that, would be a smart move, though no one wants to talk about, you know, what happened with unwed mothers, but it's a part of our history. And what happened to people for years, and to not just sit there and say Roe versus Wade, forget what your opinions are on that, any side of the table. This is a story about what happened to women in this time frame, and these two women and what happened to them. And I just think there's something special about that to be blended into the so-called thing called required reading, because nothing can turn kids off more than my son read a book every day. He was in middle school. He went to high school, got required reading, never read, never. Since then, I don't think he's picked up a book. Good gamer, good gamer. But, and every single day that kid's head was in a book. And then when you start to read dry things, you think that that's all the adult books.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So here we go. This should be on required reading this summer.
Yeah.
For a whole group of students. And it's funny because every once in a while people will protest. And we had a big protest over some book that was Q4 of senior year. Kids were 18. I was like, okay, they're adults. All right. Number one. And number two, I said to the parents, let me just think about something else. Are you going to quiz them on their college textbooks? Are you going to look at the syllabus and say, I don't want you reading X or Y or Z? Because I saw what that's next. So if you're curious, that's what's next. Do you know every book your kid's reading in college? No. Do you have?
No. I do ask only because I want to read along with him so we can have a conversation. So I have, for his English class, I have been saying, let me know what you're going to read because I'll read it too and we can talk about it, you know, but not because I want to censor it, but more so I just want to have, I just want to have something we could talk about. You know, when you have a son, you're just looking for a place to connect, right?
The best place is in the car when they're in the passenger seat. That's the best because then you have a captive audience. He's on that. I have two sons. No. You can't get the real feelings out. You know, let's go for a ride.
Yeah.
Look, such a pleasure. Can't wait to see what you do next. I'm what direction is she going to go in? And I figure it'll be a couple of years.
Well, I'm just starting. So we'll just see. We'll just let the universe does what it do. And I'll get back to you, but I'll be back to talk about it. Right. So we'll meet back here when it's done.
And you're going to have another good day. In between. You're going to have a lot of good days.
Yeah, a lot of good days in between.
I'm going to start adapting that. I'm going to have a lot of good days.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure to be back with you again. And to our viewers and listeners, we'll see you next time on Book Reporter Talks 2. Remember, you can find us on YouTube to watch videos, podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again, everybody. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The House of Eve by Sadiqa Johnson, narrated by Ariel Blake and Nicole Lewis, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks 2. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks 2. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The House of Eve by Sadiqa Johnson, narrated by Ariel Blake and Nicole Lewis, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
My grandma Nini always said that early was on time was late, and late was unacceptable. Fatty was unacceptably late again, knowing full well that I had someplace important to be. I didn't mind staying with Grandma Nini overnight once a week so that Fatty could clean offices. All I asked was that she be home in time for me to catch the bus to my Saturday enrichment classes. And for the third week in a row, Fatty dragged her heavy feet through Nini's apartment door 15 minutes behind schedule, calling out in her high-pitched voice, "Ruby girl, I'm sorry. Let me tell you what happened." My cousin had more excuses than a hoe going to jail, and I didn't have time to entertain her colorful tales this morning. I had 1 hour to get all the way down to South Philly, and I twisted up my lips in a way that I hoped conveyed how annoyed I was over her lack of consideration. "You got my car fare?" I thrust my hand in her face. But Fatty brushed past me in the narrow hallway, past the crooked family pictures that hung in mismatched frames, through to the small L-shaped kitchen. I stomped behind her as she snatched back her page boy wig and tossed it on the counter. "Your mother said she'd leave it for you." A baby cockroach scurried from under the toaster, and Fatty smashed it dead with her palm. "You gonna make me walk all the way back in the opposite direction? Just give me 20 cents. "I would if I could," she said, scrubbing her hands at the apron sink. "But I'm broke as a joke girl until next Friday." My scalp heated. "Grandma ain't got no money around here? What if my mother forgot?" "Child, I talked to Inez last night. She said she would. Now quit wearing out my nerves. If you leave now, you'll make it." Fatty reached into the ice box and cracked open a can of Schlitz. She tipped it to her lips and took a long swallow, then exhaled in a way that suggested that she had been thirsting for that beer her whole way home. After another hungry swig, she undid the buttons to her blue uniform down to her waist. The rolls around her middle sighed with relief. "Did Nini take her medicine?" I snatched up my school bag, nodding my head with frustration. "She's been asleep 20 minutes. Her next eye dosage is at 11. With the front door open, I could smell scrapple frying from the new neighbor's apartment on the first floor. She had twin babies who kept up a chorus of crying all night long. "I'm not doing this for you no more," Fatty belched, then called after me. "I said I was sorry. Damn, girl, what you want, blood?" I slammed the door in response, then felt bad, hoping I hadn't disturbed Nini. The piece of toast I had prepared for my journey was now cold and stiff with butter. I shoved the bread in my mouth as I ran down the two flights of stairs and out onto 28th Street. A dampness clung to the air from last night's rain, and I had to sidestep wet leaves that had gathered in potholes. I had been marked tardy for the last 3 weeks in a row, and Mrs. Thomas said if I was late to one more enrichment class, she was writing me up. I wondered if Fatty was messing with my future on purpose. Everyone, even Fatty, knew how prestigious it was to be selected to participate in the Armstrong Association's We Rise program. As one of 12 Negro students chosen from across the city of Philadelphia, I was competing to receive a full 4-year scholarship to Cheney University, the oldest historically Negro college in the country. To earn it, I had to be impeccable in every way, and being on time was a requirement. If I wasn't awarded the scholarship, I could forget all about going to college for optometry. No one in my family had been to college, nor could they afford to send me. I refused to let Fatty's disregard for time muddy up my future, especially since she hadn't even finished high school.